Lecture 30, Henry David Thoreau, Walden.
In our last lecture, we completed our discussion of Goethe's Faust, that magnificent epic poem in two parts. The first part had as its theme love, romantic love, love that can destroy. Faust seduced and then abandoned Gretchen, and she caused the death of her own mother and their own child. In the second part, we saw Faust redeemed in the end. After following his ambition to the absolute limits, he was redeemed, not by himself, for he died having ordered a murder, did he not? But through the divine love of God, through the Virgin Mary, and then through Gretchen herself praying for him. We have examined in the course of this set of lectures a series of epic poems, the Iliad, Gilgamesh, and Beowulf, the Aeneid, Dante's Divine Comedy, and the epic has been the vehicle for some of the noblest ideas in literature. Sir Thomas Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur is an epic, not in poetry, but dealing with epic material and in its magisterial prose, it too conveys an epic. And like Dante's Divine Comedy, or the Faust of Goethe, or the Aeneid, it is a story of redemption. Redemption. We live in a society in which people are not allowed to forget mistakes. Not even the most powerful politician in the world can avoid something they did when they were 21 years of age. It will always come back, and of course, with our inexhaustible supply of news media, it can always be resurrected and there to haunt that person. And who is courageous enough to say, yes, I did that. I was a different person then. Now I have changed. So it is a society that cannot accept the notion of redemption, even though redemption lies at the very center of Christianity, of Islam, or as we saw, the Bhagavad Gita. Redemption. Remember, you can be the greatest sinner in the world, but if you come to see that God is truth, you will be saved, the Bhagavad Gita tells us. Epic poetry has been the source of great inspiration, as has the philosopher, the searcher after the truth. Socrates, or Jesus. Confucius. Now, Socrates believed that epic poems and the epic poet were not true philosophers, in the sense that they could convey great ideas. They got all inspired, Homer did, but they could not then sit down and analyze them. And he was always going around to the poets of his day, like Sophocles, whom he particularly disliked, and asking them to explain some particularly truth-sounding poetry that they had produced on the stage at Athens. That, of course, made Socrates disliked. Socrates liked to call himself a gadfly. And the subject of today's lecture, the lecture that we're on right now, Henry David Thoreau, was another such gadfly and searcher after the truth. Socrates, of course, made himself so unpopular that he was put to death. And, you know, looking at these figures like Socrates and Thoreau, in terms of our own society, our Solzhenitsyn, who was just such a gadfly and made himself disliked not only in the Soviet Union but in the United States. I mean, that took a certain amount of ability. Socrates would have admired that. We would call such people, we might say they had a chip upon their shoulder, wouldn't we? I mean, why else would they go around saying things weren't perfect? Everybody knew the Athenian democracy was perfect. Everybody knew that the Soviet Union was perfect. And everybody knew that the United States was perfect. And here you have these figures going around saying, well, it's not. And I'm telling you this for your own good. And not only for your own good, but for the good of my soul. That is my mission in life, is to go around and tell you that you have mistakes, because I know I have mistakes, and by helping you understand your mistakes, I can deal with my own mistakes. I can redeem myself. So you get in big trouble doing that. And Henry David Thoreau spoke out against conformity in the United States in an age in which Americans thought they were moving ever forward to being the greatest nation in the world, same way we do today, and quite rightly. Because after all, America had established itself with its Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It had then established a constitution which by 1845, when Thoreau would go out to Walden Pond, had taken this democracy over a good part of the continent, bidding fair to have the whole of the continent under democracy. We are, a contemporary of Thoreau said, Herman Melville, the bearer of the Ark of Liberty to the entire world. And we were becoming a leading industrial power. Why, American factories were turning out goods in huge quantities. Our cities were beginning to bloom and blossom and become enormous, cities like New York or Boston. And railroads were making their way across the country, bringing people ever faster to places. Why, bringing the mail ever faster, the same way today, that we just communicate ever faster and faster, and it became ever easier, to use today's language, to stay connected. And that is what people wanted to do, to stay connected. There were newspapers, and they got to your doorstep very fast now, and you could read the news of the entire world and be an informed citizen to make decisions in this democracy, the same way you can today. I mean, you can wake up in the middle of the night, what, 2 a.m., not able to sleep. You can turn on the news and find out what's going on and inform yourself and make these decisions. So the world of Thoreau was much like our own in terms of its belief in progress and in democracy. And all of this did not suit this one man who was eccentric. Now, to say about somebody in a job today that they are eccentric is not a letter of recommendation. John Stuart Mill, of course, said the whole purpose of individual liberty was to defend eccentricity. But eccentrics have chips on their shoulders and they're gadflies. And Thoreau was just such an eccentric. He had gone to Harvard. He came from a perfectly respectable family. No reason to think he would turn out like this. He did perfectly well at Harvard. He would have studied Greek and Latin in the original, studied natural philosophies, a certain amount of science, studied moral philosophy. But then he did not go out and get a good job. He taught for a short while, but he realized that if you spend all your time teaching people, you never learn anything. And so that's what he said. I wouldn't say that, but he said that. He never learned anything, so he stopped doing that. And he had tried to write a little bit, but nobody ever wanted to publish it. He got no money for it. I mean, he was a failure. And like a failure, well, maybe he developed a chip on his shoulder. So at the age of 28, July the 4th, 1845, when his countrymen were celebrating their independence, he celebrated his independence by going out to Walden Pond near Concord. In Concord, there were a circle of people who knew him and liked him and respected his eccentric ways, people like Ralph Waldo Emerson the Alcotts. And he would consider himself, like Emerson and the Alcotts, a transcendentalist. That is to say, he believed that ideas were most important. Thus he joined Socrates in the belief that ideas shape everything. And this was very different than most of his countrymen who believed in practical, empirical information. He also called himself a mystic. And a mystic is someone by his very nature, her very nature, who is cut off from the factual reality of the world. He read and took seriously German philosophy, particularly Kant. He knew Plato well, but he above all thought for himself, and that is what he wanted to do when he went out to Walden Pond, to cut himself off as much as possible from contemporary life. He did not become a hermit. People came and visited him, and he was perfectly genial as a host. But he wanted to disconnect and to give his eccentricity full rein. And he understood, as Socrates did, who cared nothing for material possessions, that our material possessions are the fetters, the chains that bind us. He is, Thoreau, a very selfish person. He did not want to be bound by any concerns. The same way Socrates was very selfish, remember? Towards the end of his life, when he's in prison, his friends say, "You've got to escape and go into exile, Socrates, because who will take care of your children?" He said, "I don't care. I don't care." And so Thoreau was selfish. And he realized if you are going to achieve fulfillment, if you are going to develop your inner self, your soul, then you must be selfish. So he set out to decide how little you really need to live. And it is an amazingly little if you will just think about it. All you need is some kind of covering and something to eat. And you can produce all of that yourself. So he, even though he was by no means a skilled craftsman, he built himself a little cabin. And it suited him. Most people would think it was a terrible looking structure, but it suited him. It kept the wind and rain out most of the time. And there he could fix his meager little meals. All it took was a garden. And it was amazing how much nourishment you could get just from potatoes or beans. And more than that, how much fulfillment there was in taking care of yourself, being dependent on no one, because then your time was truly your own. You were not rushing back and forth to be somewhere at 8 o'clock in order to fulfill your job. You were not looking at the clock constantly because you were doing somebody else's work. Remember that from the Bhagavad Gita, because now, as we come to the end of our lectures, we want to bring these together. Bhagavad Gita says to do someone else's work is slavery, to do your own is freedom. And do you know what book Thoreau liked best? The Bhagavad Gita. He read the Indian classics. In fact, he said, "I had a copy of the Iliad on my table there at Walden Pond, and from time to time I would look at a page of it. But in fact, most I was spoken to by the works from other civilizations." Do we know, he said, "you who study Greek and Latin, that the Vatican could be filled up with a whole set of holy books from Persia, from the Islamic world, from India, and from China? Look widely." So he labored at his own task. He would lie for a whole day just baking bread and watching it bake there in the oven. Or some days he would just lie all day and watch the grass and contemplate and meditate. He found himself in a world that was surrounded and filled with information. And some people took the trouble to turn that into knowledge, but almost nobody took the time to contemplate and to meditate that led to wisdom. And that is what Thoreau wanted to do. For us, Walden is a magnificent examination of the theme of nature. We all should come to grips with nature. We saw that in the age of the Enlightenment, men and women thought they should control nature. And in the Romantic age that Goethe lived to see, nature was an overwhelming force that gave you renewal. Well, our society in the early 21st century has made its decision. We control nature. Nature is to be bent to our will. You can't think anything else when you drive up the highways of America and you look along the sides and see one McDonald's, followed by a Wendy's, followed by a Burger King, followed by a car dealerships, followed by an Applebee's, and so on. All that wonderful, fruitful land covered over with asphalt and fast food places. We control nature. Yes, we have natural parks, national parks like Yellowstone, in which we have carefully cut off and isolated nature, and where you go in and there are officers to let you in, officers to control you at every step of the way, officers to make sure you have a permit to walk into the backwoods. And that's all good, no doubt. But our idea is that we control nature. Thoreau wanted to be controlled by nature, to subordinate himself to nature so he would understand it. So the routine of the crops, came to mean something to him. And the routine of nature there on the pond, where he stayed for 2 years, watching and recording. I'm a natural philosopher to boot, he said. I'm a mystic, a transcendentalist, and a natural philosopher to boot. And he was a scientist, pretty much self-trained. But in that little microcosm of the universe that was Walden Pond, there he studied nature. Have you ever looked at the ice in the winter? It changes. It gets deeper, and then sometimes it gets shallower, and it makes noises, strange noises, if you'll attune your ear. So he studied the depth of ice in Walden Pond, thought about the elements that made its color different from the ice you might cut in further in Concord or in Boston. Noticed the patterns of birds and how they migrated. Looked at the stars over and over again just to wonder about them. So he immersed himself in nature out of the belief that nature is sacred and we are all part of nature. So he began to have reservations about eating animals. You could get all the nourishment you wanted from vegetables. And first he fished. And that seemed to be him to be part of nature, because herons came and caught fish. But taking an animal, have you ever gutted a pig? First you've killed that creature, and then it is just dirty. The whole work is dirty. So he said, I'm not going to eat any more meat. And finally, he came to feel that perhaps he wouldn't eat any more fish either. They too were part of nature, and why was he preying upon them when he could get everything he wanted from his potatoes and his beans and his salad? So he took a real commitment to be part of nature. Seldom reading, pondering a lot. Friends coming to see him from time to time just to see that he hadn't totally lost his mind, because it was just so bizarre what he was doing out there and not getting along with the work of his life, as though finding himself were not the true work of his life. People always ask that of Socrates. You ought to be getting on with the work of your life, or at least participating in politics, which is the work of an Athenian citizen. And Socrates could never make most of them understand that learning yourself should be the work of your life. Spring came to Walden Pond, and Thoreau saw spring as he had never seen it before. The world becoming alive, the plants springing up out of the dead earth, and he found in the renewal of spring that same mystic sense of redemption that we have found in our great epic poets. Remember, where does Dante begin his journey to save his soul? At Easter time. What brought Goethe back from suicide? Faust and Goethe's great work. What brought him back from suicide? Spring and Easter. And when did the Greeks, the Athenians, put on their tragedies that are all about your redeeming yourself through understanding the suffering and learning wisdom from what happened to others in the spring? And Thoreau understood that this is a mystical time. Now, once again, if you're living your everyday life, Thoreau would say, with a chip on his shoulder, not me, but Thoreau would say, you're just missing the whole of spring and all of nature. All spring might mean is that the roads are going to begin to get slushy, and then, well, you got some flowers outside, maybe, if you plant them and carefully nurture them, but it is just one more part of your year, isn't that right? Because it all runs together, not for Thoreau. God, inside him, was renewing the whole world. Thus he writes in Walden Pond, having gone through each season there at the pond, he says, you know, on a bright spring day, it became absolutely clear to me, why doesn't the jailer go into his prison and say, everybody is released, you are all redeemed? And why doesn't a minister say to his congregation on that bright blue day in spring, everybody just go away. Just go away. You don't need to be in a building. God is far more present in these trees coming back to life than he is in all the cathedrals ever built by man. And God is more alive in these birds and their singing in the spring and celebrating the spring than in all the hymns, all the books ever composed by men and women. And the teacher ought to say, go away, students, be free. And Thoreau said, you know, I have on this spring day forgiven everybody who ever did anything wrong to me. Why should I allow them to continue to control me? Because that's what they're doing. By constantly thinking about the wrong they have done to me, petty or great, then they continue to control me and I am no longer free. So you're all forgiven. And I just wish everybody, everywhere, could be free like that and say, in spring, all debts are forgiven. Why, yes, why doesn't the creditor go to you and say, I have forgiven you your debts? Well, again, when Thoreau tried to explain this to his friends, they couldn't grasp it. They might even have said, well, someone has pissed on your wick. You're really losing all your ardor for life if you can't hate people. No, it's because I have all this ardor for life that I want to live it, Thoreau said. I want to live because I have this ardor for life. And in the course of spring, in the course of thinking, he asked questions that are still very much, should be very much in our mind, but make it clear how eccentric he was, because it sounded just as eccentric to his friends as it will to you. But he asked the question, how many letters have you gotten in your life that were worth the postage? Think about it. How many letters have you gotten that really transformed what matters in your life? Or you might have gotten some letters you thought were good at the time, offering you a job that just increased your servitude. You might have gotten a letter that, gave you opportunities in the far west that just increased your servitude. How many letters have you got that were really good, good for your soul? Maybe one or two in a lifetime? Well, just stop getting mail. It takes away even a few minutes of your time, but you today, and again, this would be Thoreau speaking, how long do you sit every day at your email? Because not only now do you have letters coming in, though they're fewer, you have the telephone jangling, the fax, all of these intruding upon you, but that email, that has become sacred. No one dare say, I did not look at your email. I don't look at mine. I've got 1,500 emails blocked up there, and I'm not going to look at one. I haven't looked at one since March 24th. Now, they would think you were either completely irresponsible, but if you held a position, you'd have to be crazy. You have suffered a nervous breakdown. Truly, someone has pissed on your wick. You have lost all your ardor for life if you're not going through those emails. Now, isn't that true? Yes or no? How about you? Yes, you know it's true. All right. Thoreau would say, just throw that computer away. You're not writing any better or communicating anything that is important with it. Oh, that's pretty drastic, you might say. But I don't think anyone will follow this goal of throwing away their computer, because we must be connected. And we are, of course, connected every day through the news. And Thoreau never read a newspaper. And his friend said, how can you be a responsible citizen and not read the newspaper, keep informed? And Thoreau said, you know what? If you read a newspaper from 25 years ago, just change a few names, and it is saying exactly what is true today. And he picked up a newspaper that one of his friends was so diligently studying and said, look, here's some news about what's happening in Spain. Now, just change a name here or here of the prime minister or the king of Spain, and it's exactly the same. Well, interestingly enough, the other day I was reading Winston Churchill's book on the world crisis, the end of World War I, and there he had an appendix there in which he had sent a memorandum to the prime minister about Iraq. We're trying to nation build in Iraq. It's not going well. There may be a civil war there. British troops are being killed every day, and the British taxpayer is getting very upset at this huge expenditure. Well, I just ask you if there's truth in what Thoreau says. So, newspapers and keeping up with the news is one more way in which you destroy your ability to commune with yourself, because sooner or later, it's just like eating so much meat. You get so much impurity in yourself from the outside world that you can never break free of it, and you have thus lost forever that chance to save your own soul, Thoreau said. And after 2 years, he was done at Walden Pond. I had other paths to trod, and that, too, is an important lesson for you. You don't have to stay in the same thing or the same idea all the rest of your life. People might say to him, as they did, how are you contradicting yourself? You know, you said you were going to go out there, now you're leaving it. Well, all right, never be afraid to contradict yourself. Never be afraid to say, I've learned enough, or I'm never going to learn anything in this idea, and I'm going on to something new. So I had other worlds to look at, said Thoreau, and you know what? I could go out to the far west. Why, I could sail all the way out to Hawaii. I could go to the land of the antipodes, out to Australia. But why? I have the most uncharted world in the universe inside me. I have only begun to explore myself. So wherever I am, I can explore myself. And that's what I should be doing instead of spending, he would say to you, hours in an airport somewhere to go off to look at some museum somewhere, when all of it is within me. The beauty of nature can never be surpassed by any work of art that you're going to find in a museum. And you know what? If you do want to read, think of that Indian classic. Think of the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedas, which point out to you that every morning is new and fresh. Every morning you can begin again. And do you know what? The sun is a morning star. That's how he ends Walden. Think about it. The sun that lights the whole world is a creature of the morning. And every day you can start your life anew. All you want, you're just flipping through your notes there and pondering, but every day is new and fresh if you will seize that chance. Like Socrates, however, Thoreau, as a person of conscience, as one who said, yes, I'm eccentric because I march to a different drummer. And every time you say somebody is out of step, what they're really doing is marching to their own drummer. And I'm going to tell you, as Socrates did, that your democracy is not perfect. In fact, it has on it a terrible stain, and it's called slavery. But you know, you merchants in Boston whose contributions to the campaign of legislators send them to Washington, you make too much money out of trade with the South to want to get rid of slavery. And you Southerners, you've become so corrupted in your soul that you'll never get rid of slavery. And we're now fighting a war with Mexico, he said in 1846, that has as its only goal to spread slavery. I'm not going to pay taxes. Well, everybody should pay taxes. Taxes go to all kinds of good things. I'm not going to. And so he was thrown in jail. One of his friends came and bailed him out, but that's all right. They wanted to bail him out. They could do that. Didn't hurt him. Didn't hurt his soul. Because he said, if we have true freedom, then we ought to be free enough for the state to say, well, there are 10 people in the state of Massachusetts who aren't going to pay their taxes. Leave them alone. I don't care. Let's respect freedom in that way. But he found one man he could admire, John Brown. And in 1859, when John Brown seized that arsenal at Harper's Ferry, when he was taken prisoner, tried and hanged very quickly, there were no 9 or 10 year delays with John Brown. He was taken prisoner in October, and December he was hanged. All those wealthy, high-browed, good-meaning people in New England who had supported him with money, suddenly washed their hands and burned their files and wanted no one to know they'd ever had anything to do with John Brown. Not Thoreau. He wrote an essay on John Brown. John Brown is the man of conscience. John Brown, who had come to understand from his own internal searching that slavery was such a great wrong, it could only be removed by bloodshed and civil war. There, said Thoreau, is a man worth following. If you want to be part of the world, then do it the way John Brown did. Fight and die for something that truly means freedom. That was Thoreau's legacy. the love nature? Because in nature, you find the way to your own truth.